What's up, guys? This is Justin, and you are listening to my podcast, The Quest, where we dive into the interesting stories of the trailblazers around me. So first things first, if you have feedback for the podcast, please, 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 please hit us up on social media. I'm at Justin Kahn on IG, Twitter, and TikTok, and we respond and read every comment that you send. Well, we try our best. We often ask you who you want me to bring on the show, and so you can hit us up with suggestions on socials. Also, we've got a new Substack mailing list called The Quest Digest. Sign up from a link in the show notes for episode summaries and more. My guest today is Mark Cuban. I am so excited for this. Mark doesn't really need an intro from me, but he's a serial entrepreneur and investor, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, and a shark on ABC's Shark Tank. In our conversation, we talk about Mark's entrepreneurial hustle, learning from failure and getting fired, non-fungible tokens and crypto, his new cost-plus prescription drugs company, his life as a father, and much more. I really love Mark's positive energy and insatiable curiosity to learn new things. Personally, I've looked up to Mark for a long time as one of the pioneers in internet streaming, and it was really awesome to have this convo. So without further ado, here is Mark Cuban. I'm so excited.
Dude, I'm telling you, my hair is going to be as long as yours because we're not allowed, NBA quarantine, we're not allowed to go out and get haircuts, nothing.
So you're going to have to grow it out. This is 2 years for me. I've been working hard on this.
When I was in high school, mine was almost as long as that, but I cut it for college.
You cut it for college and then it's never been the same since?
It's been bushy, but never down to my shoulders.
That's awesome. Well, I really, really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me. I'm excited to do it. And so on the podcast, the goal is really just to dig into the ups and downs and stories of, you know, people who are trailblazers and have been successful. In my own experience, you know, I really, really wanted to make it in the world, you know, as an entrepreneur and a successful executive and founder. And I thought, like, if I just got this, you know, successful outcome, like all my problems would be solved. But then I did, you know, we sold Twitch for almost $1 billion and it was the same, you know, I was kind of like, wait, this is it, you know? And so after that, I went on a journey of really finding things that mattered to me. And I realized that was something that was kind of beyond all these things that maybe I thought mattered. Part of the podcast is just to tell that story and how other people have experienced it. So, I mean, I feel like you've probably been through the whole ringer on that. And I'd love to kind of hear it.
Where do you want to start?
Well, I'd love to start at the beginning. You know, you're someone who've always committed to outworking everyone around you, you know, and you seem to have that DNA built in. So was it always like that? Was it there from a young age or was there something that kind of formed that?
When I was a kid, it was always about making money because we didn't have a lot. But as I got older, it really just became about freedom and having my own time. You know, my dad did upholstery on cars and, you know, it was 6, sometimes 7 days a week that he was working and just was always in pain when he came home. And, you know, he always really tried to let me know that the one thing in life you don't own is your time. If you're working for somebody else, you're at somebody else's command. And he never liked that. But he didn't go to college, so he didn't really understand what he could do next. And at young ages, I would be buying and selling everything from trash bags door to door to baseball cards to stamps and coins, you name it. And he would just tell me, I don't have a clue what you're doing. You've got to figure it out. And that kind of propelled me because that's what I've always done. I've just figured it out and tried to get to a point where I could reach my goal. And my goal really was just to retire. At the beginning, it wasn't like, okay, I need more money than everybody. And it never became that. It was how much money do I need so I could just quit working and just party like a rock star. And that was always my motivation.
How much was that?
So I sold my first company when I was 29, 30 years old, and that was $5 million. And I ended up with what I had to bank about $2.5-3 million after taxes. And, you know, I'd read this book, How to Retire by the Age of 35. And its big thing was just live like a student, right? If you live like a student, you can make money last a long ass time. And so that's what I did. I lived cheap and I bought a lifetime pass in American Airlines. And I just got going. And now, fortunately, right when that happened, I was able to start investing in stocks because, you know, I had a technology company, my first company, Micro Solutions, for 8 years. And I learned a lot about integrating and network and software and all this stuff. And I had a better feel for it and knowledge of the details of it than a lot of Wall Street. And so, you know, when I first sold the company, I told my broker, I want to live like a 60-year-old man, right? We're just live really, really cheap and be really conservative because this has got to last me a lifetime. But then he would always have me talk to their analysts and they would ask me all these questions and I would see the stock move all over the place. And he's like, dude, you know more than our analysts. You've got to start buying and selling these stocks. And that's what I did. And then I started crushing it there. And that gave me more freedom. And then we started AudioNet after that. And I went back to work. But my whole mission, you know, it was never about, okay, I need to be a billionaire or I need to be the richest guy on the planet. None of that. It was, okay, I just want to buy my time. And after I sold that business, I was making money in the market. I partied like a rock star, bought a lifetime pass in American Airlines, went to I don't know how many different countries, partied with, you know, people I'll never see again and you know, would never remember me, but just passed all over the place.
And so how did you get that urge to start another company and start AudioNet? You know, you could do anything.
Yeah. So, I mean, I had more money than I ever dreamed of at that point. And my buddy from college, Todd Wagner, and I used to get together all the time just to have lunch and just shoot the shit. And he's like, look, you know, I've been talking and thinking about this new internet thing. This is late 94. And he's like, there's got to be a way that we can listen to Indiana basketball over the internet. Because at that point in time, we'd get a bunch of guys together and put a speakerphone there. And then we'd all be sitting drinking beer by a speakerphone and somebody else in Bloomington, Indiana would have a speakerphone next to a radio. And I'm like, okay, let me figure it out. I've done networking before. There's got to be a way to do this because, you know, it's the internet. And so that's what we did. So we started it. And initially, I put up 75 grand and I was only going to be an advisor. Then I put another 250 grand because I liked it even more. And I became the vice president. I wasn't going to work full time. I was retired. And then I put up a lot more because it was like, oh, this shit could be big. You know, this could really be the real deal. And that's when I decided to go for it.
Yeah. So you kind of fell into it, I guess.
I mean, because we knew, I mean, to me, there was no doubt that, you know, the internet was going to follow the same price performance curve that technology has followed for decades, you know, Moore's Law. And so I knew it was going to happen. I just didn't know if it'd be us. And I just didn't know when. But there's a picture back there of me talking to all of our employees in front of this little building. And by the way, this building we're in front of, I bought for 90 grand and put a basketball court in half of it. It was in this warehouse part of town. And it was just going to be my little party pad, you know, for my bachelor party pad. And then it became our office, and it's still an office. But I stood in front of them, in front of our 15 or whatever employees. And I said, look, everybody. I really believe the internet's going to be the next broadcast medium and we're going to just blow up television. And if it works, this is going to be a $5 billion company. If it doesn't, we'll be friends. So that's the mission. If y'all are in, let's go. And so we just started going for it.
That's amazing. And then it was a pretty quick ride right into the Yahoo acquisition.
It really was.
And I think oftentimes people look at that retroactively for a long time, actually, like probably 10-15 years, people were like, oh, that was like the worst acquisition that Yahoo made. But you were onto something, right? Because what you foresaw has happened, right? Like,
yeah, there's two different things. Why did Yahoo buy it? And what did they do with it afterwards?
Right.
Now, did Yahoo screw it up? Hell yeah, they did, right? When the stock bubble burst and their board said, we just got to cut everything. So they cut everything they had, you know, except for the basics, and screwed it up bad. And they'd admit that now. But you know, if you look at the things that we did back then, we dominated streaming.
Yeah.
Period end of story. You know, we were YouTube. We had user uploaded content, mostly businesses at that point in time, but we had self-generated content. We had live shows that people put on. We had, you know, live comedy shows. We had on demand like this. We had, you know, hundreds of radio stations. We had, you know, maybe I don't even know how many internet only radio station. We had police scanners from all these different cities. We had all year long, we had Christmas music. So if you wanted a Christmas music, all the stuff that you see on Pandora and Spotify, you know, we had a CD jukebox where we would get rights. Actually, we didn't even need rights until they changed the digital copyright laws. But after that, we would go to all these different artists and say, put it up here so people can listen while they're at work, right? Because you couldn't put a radio on your desk at work back then. And now you don't need to, but you know, so we like Matchbox 20, their big first hit, whatever it was, broke on our CD jukebox. We had Willie Nelson releasing CDs on there. It was great. But then Yahoo got it, and you know, it was unfortunate. They were like, you know, we're going to do all this stuff. We're going to put Yahoo's traffic on top of broadcast, and you're getting millions of users. We'll make that hundreds of millions of users. And then when the internet stock market crashed, you know, their board, it wasn't even the CEO or anything, their board just went nuts and closed everything.
And so what's it been like to watch basically your vision come to life? You have Spotify and Pandora, you have Netflix, you have all the streaming sports that are happening on NBA and NFL, you have YouTube, Hulu. It's like you had that vision in the beginning and now it's all come to life in the last 20 years.
It's cool. I mean, it happened slower than I expected to. Like if you go back to the stuff I would say back then, oh, by 2010, television will be destroyed, right?
Yeah.
And there were, you know, there were things that surprised me along the way. The biggest thing, and you know, a lot of this was just our approach, you know, was copyright. So like the way for the first, I don't know, all the years, I guess, of broadcast.com, we were very strict about copyrights. We had lawyers, you know, if we didn't have a signed permission from the copyright owner, we couldn't put it on. And then, you know, the surprise part was YouTube comes along, doesn't give a shit about copyright. And then they get the EFF to say, no, you don't understand. This is user-generated content that can be hosted. No. And our lawyers had always told us, no, that's not the way it works. But that was the first thing. If we had known then, you know, if we were allowed to do that back then, would have been a whole different ballgame. And then the second thing was bandwidth, right? Bandwidth didn't fall in terms of price and availability as quickly as I expected. So it took a lot longer. And when it did, I kind of thought it would take even longer than it ended up happening. So these last 5 years, we've seen the cost of bandwidth just plummet so that, you know, it costs next to nothing to do a video podcast, whereas, you know, 10 years ago would have been expensive as hell.
Yeah, even 10 years ago when we were racking servers for Twitch, I remember that was...
Yeah, I mean, think about that. You had to rack servers.
Yeah.
The servers were expensive, right? The bandwidth was ungodly, and it scared the shit out of you, right? Because the amount of bandwidth that you needed, that, you know, you had to find somebody on the other side to help you because otherwise you're fucked.
Yeah, yeah. We were right at that curve where it was kind of almost not making sense. Like we were spending tens of millions on infrastructure, like on bandwidth. You know, we had paid peering agreements and it was like, and then the advertising was like just getting there. So there was kind of like one or two years where it was pretty sketchy.
What year was that?
That was like 2010, 2011. And then,
yeah. Imagine 10 years earlier,
yeah.
Right? 12 years earlier, right? We had thousands of servers. And literally a big part of my job was trying to go and do peering arrangements and paying all these different peers to upgrade their infrastructures to support multicast.
Yeah.
Because multicast was going to be our big solution, right? And we spent way too much, but we had the only multicast peer-to-peer network in the country and it was starting to work. And then bam, again, Yahoo just shut that shit down.
But I mean, it worked out in the end. And now fast forward, you sold it to Yahoo, became a billionaire, hedged at the right time, preserved your wealth. And everyone probably thinks, Mark Cuban, you've got it figured out in 2020. But like, what's the pandemic been like for you?
I mean, like everybody else, it's scary. You know, the anxiety levels are enormous. And it doesn't matter how much money you have, that virus don't give a shit, right?
Yeah.
And so I got kids. My kids are 11, 14, and 17. And so I'm terrified about them. You know, my 17-year-old daughter thinks she's, you know, immune to all that. And that's a battle. And so, yeah, there's challenges like every parent has right about now. Now, I'm obviously very fortunate. There's a lot of things I don't have to worry about. But there's still, when it comes to your kids, you know, that's everything. And the pandemic has been scary for all of us.
Yeah, that's one thing that's come up for me is I just had my first kid last year.
Congrats.
Thank you. 15 months old now. And, you know, not knowing the long-term effects of, you know, it seems like it's fine for kids, but you don't know what the long-term effects are. So we've been very cautious.
Yep, you got to be. It's scary. It's really scary. But, you know, I think a lot of things have come out of this that'll be positive. You know, we pay more attention to vaccines. I think we're going to see some blockchain-based companies that just change the game, change the music game, change the digital goods game. And when we look back, we'll look at the pandemic of 2020, particularly the summer, and say, okay, that was the inflection point for a lot of blockchain-based applications.
Oh, actually, I wanted to ask you about one of those. Because, you know, I'm particularly interested in NFTs and like the culture around, you know, what is real value, right? What's the store of value? What are people interested in buying? And I know, you know, the NBA just released NBA Hot Shots, right? With the guys who did CryptoKitties. And it's to me, it's like such a fascinating idea of like, you could own this moment. You know, it's such a cool application. Like, what I want to just get your thoughts on, like, where do you think the future of the NFT market is going?
So like, I was always a baseball cards guy. Like, you know, like, here's my Luka Doncic rookie card, right? And so yeah. I got it. And then, you know, and like I told you before, I sold stamps when I was a kid. And what I learned then, and it still holds now, you've got to manage this thing, right? You got to protect it,
yeah.
You know, particularly with stamps. They tear this or that, or, you know, your kids get at them and mess with them. And then when you want to sell them, you have to get them graded. What's the quality of it? And then you've got to physically deal with the transaction itself and then the financial side of the transaction and the trust elements of it. Was it graded correctly? This and that. There's a lot of hassles. The minute you go from just collecting as a kid, right, just because you want to have it, to making this potentially an investment and looking at value, there's so much hassle involved in dealing with physical goods. But the sense of ownership, when you think about digital goods, like the moments, you still have the sense of ownership, right? That's mine. I bought that. That serial number is mine. Just like this serial number for Luka Doncic is mine. But I got none of the hassles.
Yeah.
There's a marketplace there to give me value. I don't have to worry about grading it. I don't have to worry about shipping it or receiving it. I don't have to worry about, you know, who's the buyer on the other side and who's trustworthy and who's not. All those things are taken care of. And so you get all the benefits of owning a physical collectible without the hassles. And the friction is a lot less in terms of buying and selling for the most part.
Yeah.
And so I think it's going to be huge. And I think the collectible side of it is going to be this much of it. I think it's going to just completely turn upside down the music industry and the movie industry.
How will it manifest? Like when I saw Hot Shots, I was like, that's genius. Like selling the moments, people have an experience of when they were watching that moment. And, you know, there's like a kind of personal experience. How do you think that manifests for music and movies and other media forms?
Well, let's put aside Top Shots in those moments, right? Let's look at digital art. I went and I took some things that we created for the Mavs and I put them online. I minted them and then I put them on through Mintable and then I put it on Rarible, which also puts it on Rarible.com and OpenSea.io, places which are marketplaces where people can see them and value them and buy and sell them. And so I went to Mint there just so I could learn and get the experience. And all of a sudden there was this little checkbox, you know, where it says, if you'd like to keep on getting paid every time there's a transaction. And I was just like, oh my God, this is the holy grail right there. So the first thing I put on there was 10%. And, you know, because it's me and da, 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 you know, some people came and bought it because it was a series of 10, a little GIF that I did and people bought it and it kept on reselling. And every time it got resold, I made 10%. And one of them went for some obscene price, right? And I made like, you know, 4.5 Ether or something ridiculous, right?
Nice.
You know,
That's like 10 grand now or something.
Yeah, I was getting close to that, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait. So then I put up another one and I asked for 15%. Didn't change the market at all, you know, and I kept on getting paid. And now every time I go to my wallet for that stuff, I mean, if there's a transaction involved, I got paid. Now, fast forward and think, okay, what else can this be applied to that's digital? Well, music, right? Photography. So if you're a professional photographer and rather than suing everybody that uses your picture in an Instagram post, which is horrible in a lot of respects, but I understand it, now you can mint it in Unmintable as an example, and you can set what percentage. So if you're a professional photographer, you literally could ask for 90% of any future transaction and in the event someone decided to resell it. And you could decide whether or not to convey a commercial license. That's just one of the check boxes as well. So that if I want to sell this picture I took at the inauguration for $100 and convey the commercial right to it, okay, I just sold it. I don't have to go through a broker or whatever. And if the person who bought it, used it twice, decided they don't need it anymore and put it on the marketplace and wants to resell it for $50, great. I get $5 every time when that sells. And if I want to put out a series, if I want to do just one, I can charge more. If I want to do 10,000 of them, maybe only 1,000 of them sell, great. Now imagine I'm a musician, I'm an artist, and I have a song. Let's just say I already have a following. Let's just say I'm Lil Wayne, right?
Yeah.
And he comes out with a new single. And instead of releasing it to radio and putting it on Spotify and putting it on all these places looking to sell downloads, he only puts it on OpenSea, right? Mints it through Mintable, puts it on Rarible, puts it on OpenSea, and says, I get 90% of every future sale. And I'm putting 2 million of them out there, right? And maybe, you know, there's going to be an issue with transaction costs at some point, but I'm putting 2 million of them out there and I'm selling them for $1 a piece, but that's for personal use. And if you get tired of this song and you want to resell it to the next person so they don't have to download it from Amazon or download it from Google Music, then okay, that's fine. You can resell it to them and I'll get my 90% of that. And then I do a separate commercial version that I sell for $1,000 to radio stations to be able to use and to anybody else to be able to use it commercially. And boom, I'm getting paid every inch of every step of the way. You know, imagine if you're a DJ, right? And you've got to own the copyright. You know, there's not like an ASCAP BMI equivalent, there's stuff like that, but you get to control every bit of that. If you do beats instead of selling them on Beatport, you just put it out there and every time it gets resold, you own it. I mean, this is where Beatport has got to go and marketplaces like that have got to go. That's music. I got a movie, right? And I want to distribute it and I want to put it out there at $19.95. But you know what? You get tired of my movie instead of taking it like you used to a DVD store and resell the DVD and I got nothing. Great. You get tired of watching it, sell it. I don't give a shit because I get 90% of whatever you sell it for, even if it's only a dollar.
It's interesting because it's bringing back this concept of like your digital goods have value, like some resale value.
The key is you keep on getting paid.
Yeah. Yeah. As it kind of solves that problem of like the used good marketplace for the originator of the thing. And then like the buyer, the consumer feeling like there's still some store of value.
You know, if this was 1995 again, this is like the early internet days all over again. So coming up with these types of applications, I'd be going nuts. Right. I mean, literally, I'd be going to every musician I know right now, or I'd introduce myself like I did back in the day with broadcast. Be like, you don't understand internet broadcasting, but let me just tell you how I'm going to help you. Right. And we're going to take what you're doing in ABC. That's exactly what I'd be doing right now. Exactly. Same with movies, same anything digital. And, you know, anything I can make digital, particularly now, because Gen Z, they value digital goods more than anything other than maybe a house, you know, maybe a car.
Yeah.
You know, everything else in their life is their phone, their car. And, you know, if they're fortunate enough to own a house, and after that, it's digital. And, you know, they're going to respect something that's digital before they buy something that's physical.
Yeah. So how do you, you know, switching tacks a little bit, but like, how do you stay fresh on all this stuff? And how do you keep your sense of curiosity? It seems like you're on the cutting edge of everything. And then now blockchain and DeFi and crypto. And I'm just curious, it's like, how do you stay interested in what's new?
I mean, it's just, you know, Steve Jobs famously said, everything's a remix, right? And that's what I learned early on in technology. When I was first getting started, like I told myself that there's two people in the world when it came to technology. There's the people who created it and there's everybody else. And I was tied with everybody else. And so if I just put in the work, then I could get ahead of the everybody else's. May not know as much as the creators, but if I dealt with the creators, then they could teach me more. And then as I just started doing that more and more and more, reading the manuals, reading books about it, whatever it took, you started to understand all the concepts. Then I taught myself how to program in, you know, Basic and Visual Basic and some basic C stuff, even basic assembly language and database languages. And then you understood the constructs of programming. And then I got into networking and understood networking. And then every step along that, there's commonalities all the way through. So now I know if I keep up with it, whether it's artificial intelligence, whether it's blockchain, whether it's tokens, NFT, whatever it is, there are common threads across all of those things, right, that make it easier to understand if I just put in the time, if I do some tutorials, if I, you know, mint something and go through the entire process, I'm going to understand it. And then the Shark Tank side of me says, okay, what type of applications can I use to create from all this stuff that could be a good business? And that's when I start thinking in that direction, like we were just talking about.
Awesome. And tell me about your sense of play. You know, my sense is that you just are having a good time and like love play. And yeah. I'm curious, if, like, has it always been that way, or how do you keep that up? Yeah.
I was always a work hard, play hard guy. There's no doubt about it. And I always, you know, like my friends and I, we always used to say, we're not coming home until there's a story to be told. And that's kind of the way when I was single, I took advantage of things. And now it's kids, right? You know, particularly once your kids get a little older, now they're just a little bundle, right? And they're just there, and it's a wonder, and you just are in amazement every minute of every day, and you can't love it enough. And as they get older, they start developing personalities, and now it's more about my kids and just being connected to them as much as possible. And then the older they get, the less they want to connect to you. So it's just like this bastardized life that everybody has to address.
You seem to have a good time with them on. I know you create a lot of TikToks with your kids, and
I would do a whole lot more if they would let me. But yeah, let me just tell you: is it a son or daughter you have?
Son, yeah, son.
Sons are cool with dad. At least my 11-year-old son has been cool up to this point. When my daughter turned 15, she's 17 now. My wife and I got so stupid; it's like we lost every brain cell in our brain, you know. And she knows everything, and we know nothing. So that's a little bit of a battle.
Yeah,
but. Yeah, so my kids kind of dominate everything that I do right now. And you know, truth be told, this pandemic has made it even stronger because they're here and we're here. And so it's been amazing to spend that time with them.
That's
my sense of play now.
That's a blessing to like have that time with them.
Oh, yeah, of course.
How do you think about, you know, raising your kids? You obviously have a lot, you know, they have a lot of advantages and resources. I'm more personally interested in this, you know, it's like, how do you think about how to create, you know, build a great environment for them?
You look at me, I'm not fancy, right? You know, we don't have butlers. We have housekeepers. Yeah. And we have some help with them. There's no butlers. There's nobody catering to our every whim. I do my dish when I'm done eating. The kids do their dishes when they're done eating. My wife cooks or we order in. There's not like some chef that's there creating these fancy meals. We're not fancy at all. We bitch about them having the phone at dinner, and or they bitch if I have the TV on trying to watch something. And so we try to just keep it normal without, other than the obvious, that the way I grew up and the way my wife grew up.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I didn't fly on a plane until I was 16 and then not again until I was in my 20s. But they get to fly in a private plane. So there's a big difference, obviously. But we really try to convey to them that they're going to have to work their way through it. They're going to have to do things. I'm not here just to give them everything. I want them to figure it out like my wife and I have had to.
Would you want them to be entrepreneurs like you?
Whatever they want.
Yeah.
You know, my son now, after all this stock market stuff, I set up an account, he and my 14-year-old daughter as well. But he's been more active on Robinhood for them. And so he's been trading, you know, Dogecoin, and he's been trading. He bought Sony, one share of Sony, one share of Disney. He bought AMC, and then it went against him, and then it popped back up when he sold it. So he's getting all excited about it now. And so, you know, I like the fact that he's in business. My middle daughter is really creative and really introspective. My older daughter is more like me. She's just loud and go, 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 and social. So they all have their own personalities, and we're just trying to let them blossom. You know, there's not like a direction I'm trying to push them. Like my oldest daughter is looking at schools, and my only requirement is that it's not a school that's only known for partying, right? You know, she's got to have some academic component involved.
You know, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. You gotta make sure that there's an academic part. I love that. I'd like to talk a little bit about failure. You know, you've had some, and famously, I think you've been fired from your early jobs, right? Which forced you to be an entrepreneur. Were there any failures that, you know, in hindsight were just super valuable and like set you on the path?
All of them. Yeah, all of them. I mean, I learned more from the places I got fired from and the places I worked that I hated than I did from the places I liked. You know, I learned what not to do. I got fired because I went to close a sale instead of opening up a retail store and sweeping the floor, yada, yada, thinking that when I brought back a check from a closed deal, he would be all excited, and he fired me. I learned from that sales cures all. You know, that company was out of business not much later.
No.
And it just taught me so many lessons about how to deal with things, how to treat people, what to focus on. And that led to me getting started, and also taught me that when I was living six guys in a three-bedroom apartment, I had nothing to lose. Nothing, right? And so being young was the perfect time to start a business, because what was my downside? You know, we taking a seventh roommate, you know, it's just like, and so there's so much I learned from the places where things on the surface seem to go wrong, but I learned what not to do. And sometimes that's just as important as what you do.
I love that. Now, what's the kindest thing that anyone's ever done for you?
That's a great question, though, that I've never been asked. I think just being there. I mean, family first and foremost has always been there for me. You know, when I've gone through difficult times, but I think that's just it. Knowing my family is there outside my family, just having my friends, you know, my friends, I've got different groups of friends like everybody, but I have my high school group of friends that are still my friends. We do a Zoom call every Tuesday night, and normal times we get together at least once a year. I got my college friends, you know, that we still talk trash and email probably every single day. I've got my Dallas friends, my rugby friends from college, which is a different group. And then my Dallas friends that I met when I got here. So I've got all these friends that are always there for me that I'm still close with, that, you know, I still consider will always be lifelong friends. And I think that's what's been most important, because just knowing that they're still my friends, even though my circumstances may have changed more dramatically than others, that there's still that sense of normalcy, and it's still the same nicknames, still the same shit talk, still the same everything, and that they've always been there for me.
Through good times and bad, and all the difficult times as well.
Yeah, because they knew me when I was broke, right? They were my roommates when I first got to college. They were my roommates when I was in college, when I had to start a chain letter just to pay for a semester of school and all that shit. Or they covered, one of my roommates worked at a steakhouse and used to bring home extras so we could eat, you know? And so just stuff like that they've always been there for me. And they know I'll be there for them too.
That's beautiful. Like, life's all about your relationships, right? That's the kind of the most important thing that anybody has. What are the difficult times? Like, what's difficult in the life of Mark Cuban now?
I mean, it's all relative. You know, the older you get, the more, you know, when you're younger, you know, nothing breaks your body down.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, you feel you're indestructible, and it kind of plays out that way, your anecdotal evidence. But then it catches up, you know, all the shit I did when I was younger, you know, but just the same as everybody. I mean, look, I got nothing to complain about, nothing, you know, but just more about my kids. That's what stresses me more than anything. I met one time with President Obama. I mean, I've talked to him a bunch of times, and he said, when, you know, we're talking about kids one time, he said, "Mark, your kids are like your heartbeat. They just carry your heart with them wherever they go. When they walk out the door, your heart goes with them." And he's right. And it's just like everything that my wife and I are is bound up in my kids. And that's my biggest concern, particularly now. My 17-year-old daughter is social. I'm scared shitless, right? And I tell her that. But, you know, just like when we were 16, 17 years old, you feel like, you know, nothing's going to happen. And so it is what it is, just like every parent.
Yeah, she doesn't want to hear it, I'm sure.
So, no, hell no.
That's I feel you on what you were saying earlier with getting older. You know, I went skiing this last weekend and just wrecked myself, and I've been able to walk the same for, like, you know, 5 days. And I'm like, man, when I was 20, I'd just bounce back and be fine.
I mean, I've had both my hips replaced, tore rotator cuffs in both my shoulders, herniated two discs. You know, my shit's falling apart. But at the same time, I'll still go play basketball back when we could play. And even now, I'll go up and get shots up. That's kind of how I clear my head and just, you know, zone everything out, just getting shots up or playing pickup. And it didn't matter if I couldn't walk for 2 days, if I played long enough, right? It was just like, you know, that's just the way it is.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to make sure that we talked about is your new Cost Plus Drugs company. I actually incubated a pharmacy company, like a digital pharmacy called Alto, 5 years ago. You know, now we're in, I think, probably 5 to 10 states, you know, tens of thousands of patients. And, you know, I just saw it as such a broken experience. You know, like, I was like, how can this possibly be the end state of getting your prescription with less than 66% adherence rate? And, like, people don't, like, understand what they're paying for anything. But it's been like a slog, right? Like, dealing with PBMs. So for those of you who don't know, a pharmacy benefits manager, or PBM, is basically a middleman company that contracts with insurance companies. And all they do is create a formulary, or like a table of what drugs should cost what. And through doing that, they have this complicated rebate system, and they extract a huge amount of rent from the system. PBMs are one of the reasons why drugs are so expensive in America. And most of the public doesn't even know how the system works. It's a real travesty.
Yes. The minute you say dealing with PBMs, it's over.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You have no say whatsoever, and they just fuck everybody.
Yeah.
You know, it's like their business. We're not trying to help you. We're trying to fuck you, but we're going to tell you we're helping you. We're going to make everything in the whole ecosystem of healthcare more expensive for everybody. And everybody knows it.
Yeah.
Everybody knows it. And no one's going to say anything to stop it. It's just horrific.
Yeah, they have so much power, they could actually prevent you from operating basically in an area, you know? And so.
Yeah. Yeah. And they can prevent you from getting the right drug that will make you the healthiest. If you're not on the formularies and that they've approved, forget it. And that's part of the problem. And that's why we started, you know, that's a good segue, why we started Cost Plus Drugs and why I put my name on it.
Yeah.
Alex, my partner in it, came to me to do a custom pharmacy where you do custom formularies.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, we got to do something bigger, because he started talking about where drugs were made and how they were sold. And I knew a lot about PBMs, insurance companies, and the relationships and all that stuff. But what I didn't know was how a lot of generic drugs were manufactured and or not even manufactured. And so he gave me the example of I forget the name of the drug that the farmer bro jacked the price up for.
Martin Shkreli.
Martin Shkreli just took this drug that was like $750 and jacked it up to $7,500 just because he can make more money. And he went through the steps of saying, look, he didn't manufacture that drug. He bought it from a wholesaler and he just marked it up. I'm like, well, why don't we buy it from the wholesaler? So one of the first steps we did was to try to buy all the output, but they had already sold to all their output for multiple years. So we weren't able to do that. So what we decided to do was we decided to look at generic drugs that were hard to get and had been overpriced so that when you multiply the two together effectively, we would have the greatest impact. And that took us first to a drug called albendazole. Now, albendazole is for hookworm, right? So that there's still in the United States of America in 2021, in rural areas in particular, there's still hookworm epidemics where there's sewage that kids walk through and just really poor sanitation, and they get hookworm. And right now, it can cost $200 per course or more going through PBM. And so we're like, that's ridiculous. So we went and found a manufacturer of it, and we put sent somebody out there to verify the quality of manufacturing and everything. And we had them make us a couple years worth of goods. And we took the first 10,000 doses, and we partnered with the Baylor College of Medicine, and we gave them away for free.
Yeah.
And believe it or not, it's hard to give them away for free because of the PBMs. And because they're so not used to knowing what to do, so that we had to partner with the Baylor College of Medicine so they could create trials and scenarios where they were allowed to give them away for free and the doctors would enable it. And so that's our first step. We'll work with other manufacturers to increase the number of drugs that we're doing, generic drugs. In parallel to that, we're actually creating an API, which is a manufacturing facility for injectable drugs. And we're doing that in Dallas right now. We've been working on it a year. We just got all the construction permits approved, and we're going to start construction here quickly. And it's going to be all automated facility so that we'll be able to make a year or two or 3 years worth of doses and then change over the manufacturing so that then we go to another drug and then another drug and then another drug. And if that continues to work well, then we'll build another facility to do even more.
So it sounds like you guys are verticalizing through the whole stack to own just the manufacturing and then also the distribution of it to people.
Yeah, and we're talking to states and we're talking to people who can actually buy in quantity so that we can work around some of the PBMs. We'll talk with the pharmacies that have popped up that are cash only, you know, because when you work cash only, as you guys know, it can be less than even deductible, and it's cheaper just to pay cash. You know, even if you've reached your deductible, it still might end up to be cheaper to do it that way. And so we're trying to put together these partnerships, but one step at a time. We're trying to, you know, because by doing just one drug to start, we can get all our processes in place and make sure everything works and get feedback. And then we'll add another and another and another.
I mean, it's an amazing mission, and I really commend you on that. Like, do you think...
Oh, and I forgot the most important part. We're selling everything at cost plus 15%.
Right. Yeah. So it's a, you know, fixed margin. You can make money, but it's not like trying to maximize profit off of somebody who's
sick. Exactly. And we did it as a public benefit corporation. And we've even had conversations of setting aside, creating like a billion shares and setting aside 330 million shares for the American people. So there's 330 million people. We'll set one share aside for each of them and make that, you know, about 33% of the company. So all of the United States owns a third of it. You know, and it'll be up to us to do all the accounting and everything. But who knows, that might be pie in the sky, but it's just one of those things that we're talking about.
I love that. I mean, it's kind of like crypto in a way, where people are trying to bootstrap a community by distributing the wealth or the potential future value of the asset into the hands of all the people who are participants in the community.
And that's what we're talking about doing it, right? Create a token that represents one share in the company.
That's cool. Do you think this is the solution? I mean, maybe you do because you're starting the company, but like the PBM problem is so entrenched in how the American healthcare system works around prescriptions. Like, is there a legislative solution or like some other solution to that
problem? There's certainly legislative solutions. The first and foremost is, you know, there's this vicious cycle where insurance companies don't try to negotiate the lowest price.
Right.
It's crazy now that, you know, one of the great things that the Trump administration did, one of the few great things they did, was they're requiring all the pricing from hospitals for a significant list of all the services they offer. And when you go on to one of them, you'll see that they list all the pricing per insurance company. And then you see the cash price. The cash price is always lower than the insurance company price. And sometimes it's lower than the Medicare price. And so think about that. These major insurance companies negotiating with providers weren't able to come up with a price that's lower than anybody just walking in off the street with a checkbook.
Yeah.
Right? It's insane. So getting back to your question, what's the best step? I would, if it were up to me, and it's not, if it were up to me, I would create the United States Insurance Company that I would put on healthcare.gov as part of the ACA so that there's existing insurance companies that can do their thing. I'm not saying put them out of business, even though this was make them change how they do business, but create USA insurance, right? And what does that entail? Well, you know, in doing research on all this, 95% of companies with more than 5,000 employees self-insure, and they just hire somebody to handle the transactions and do some of the negotiations. Now, why can't the United States of America self-insure all the people that are eligible for the ACA? Because what's insurance? Why do you pay a premium for insurance? You pay a premium because that's how capital is built, right? You give the insurance company your premium money and they create a pool of capital to pay out claims. Well, guess what? The United States of America has the treasury. And so if USA Inc. self-insured and effectively became the insurer, you wouldn't have to charge premiums. All you would do is say, you know what? When you have a claim, and we would deal with claims far differently than a traditional insurance company would. When you have a claim, we're going to, you know, make sure it's the cash price that is part of the network we created. And we're going to say if you're below, you know, 400% of the poverty level, you don't pay anything, right? We're single payer for those people 400% or less of the poverty level. Those of you above will start at a very low percentage. You pay 1%. And if you make up to, you know, if you make money like we do, then you can pay 10% or you can pay actual or you're not eligible. You have to just pay the cash price, right? And that way, all of a sudden, everybody is part of the ACA. You don't have to sign up. Instead of just 12 million people participating out of 47 or now 57 million people eligible, everybody's immediately eligible. There's no premiums. Everybody just pays once you get to a certain level of income. You just pay for what you use and it works. The numbers work. I've had Rand Corporation look at it. It works. You know, now get somebody to actually implement it in government, that's a whole different story.
That's the next step. So how do you manage your time? How you're doing like everything, you know, you have like so many things going on. What's the day look like?
I don't do calls or meetings. You know, I do events like this, right? Podcasts, you know, interviews, just because I think they're interesting in this case. But traditionally in a business or as an investor, you're meeting with a lot of people, right? You're getting on the phone with a lot of people. I just don't. You know, I've got, if there's meetings that need to place, I have people who work for me that, you know, they don't mind doing meetings. But for the last 20 years, if you need me, you email me like you did back in the day, right? You know, and so I do everything via email. I don't need to sit in a meeting and ask, where's the coffee? Where's the donuts? Where are the cupcakes? Right? How are the kids? And then you're just going to tell me what I already know. And you can tell me all that in an email and I can go back and forth. And the beauty of it is that now I have 25 years worth of email. So when I saw you reach out to me, I'm like, okay, when did Justin first reach out to me? I can just look it up, you know, and there it was. asking about Justin.tv. And to me, that value is more important than the time I spend in a meeting. Yeah. Now, that's not to say I never do a meeting. There's just times when you have to be face-to-face, right? But the number of meetings I had in normal times, if I had one meeting a month, that was a lot. If I did three phone calls a month, that was a lot. So my people know that you're not going to get a call or meeting until, you know, there's a really good reason. Now with Zoom, it's a little bit easier because now we're used to everybody just getting online and this is fine. But still, you know, there's no transcript of this. And to me, that's lost value.
That's interesting because your email, it's like an extension of your memory. You know, I was actually trying to look up our first conversation. I think I did reach out to you like must have been 12 years ago or something about Justin TV. And we were trying to get you to invest in the company, which we our idea and the way we were presenting it was terrible. And I'm sure. So I don't.
Well, what you ended up doing, I mean, it was cool. I liked the initial concept, but I think I told you I didn't want to get back in the streaming industry because I knew how much work was involved. And then you evolved it, which was brilliant, and took it in a completely different direction. So yeah, now I feel like an idiot, but at the same time, you get all the credit because you took it in a completely different direction.
Yeah, you would never have known. You know, we were like kind of lost in the dark for years trying to figure it out. And there was the copyright concerns and the costs were like exorbitant. We were just kind of barely, at a certain point, we were $10 million in revenue and $10 million in costs to like of infrastructure, basically, and the support staff, you know, and that was like, it was a terrible business, you know.
But then, no, but that was a win to be break even like that. That was a huge step in the right direction because those stair step costs, because you know, when you want to start streaming back then, you needed to spend on the servers and the people and the bandwidth and pay those bills. And then you got the revenue.
Yeah. I remember when we launched it in 2007, we launched our own show, like me streaming to the internet. And we spent $30,000 in the first month on like streaming costs. And that was like all the money we had in the bank. That like our remaining thing, we were like,
that was the problem, right? Yeah. That's why I did not want to get back into the business, but to your credit, right? You know, you stuck it out.
Yeah.
And that was the key more than anything, I'm guessing.
Yeah, for sure. Like just surviving long enough for the bandwidth costs to come down, internet advertising revenue to go up. We kind of survived that 5 or 6 years until it happened, you know? And that was probably the key in inflection. It was like everybody knew something was going to happen here eventually, but no one wanted to be the one to fund it all the way up until like, you know,
and well, it's like YouTube, right?
Yeah.
Google hadn't come along. YouTube was toast. They couldn't afford their bandwidth bills.
Exactly. Yeah. Now it's all easy. I was listening to your Kara Swisher interview this morning and, you know, bandwidth, the costs have tanked and it's prolific and you can watch, you know, everyone can be streaming Zoom and Netflix all day now. And
I mean, just the idea that you can have a gigabit to your house.
Like we would never have imagined that. I remember paying my first gigabit, like that connection we got in the colo and paying, I don't even know how much, but it was a lot.
Normal. I mean, I remember trying to get a T3, you know, or a DS3 at 45 megabits, and it was like tens of thousands of dollars a month. It's just ridiculous. But that was the expectation. But sometimes you just got to survive that as things go your way, and you guys deserve all the credit.
Awesome. Well, we do a section normally where I bring up a guest from my Discord server. And so if you wouldn't mind.
No, this has been fun. You asked some great questions.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm just having fun with it. All right, here we go. Tops, how's it going?
Good. Thank you, Justin. Mark, great to meet you. My name is Thupin. I'm one of the Quest Fellow, and I'm going to be helping Justin.
I'm going to call you Tops.
Perfect. nice to meet you, and it's a privilege talking to you. My first question is, what's the most valuable piece of advice that you have received and something you recommend to a young entrepreneur?
Always be learning. Right? Because change is constant and most people stop putting in the time to keep on learning. It's like what we were talking about earlier, right? And you can turn into a dinosaur in a heartbeat in this industry, in the tech industry, in a business across the board. So whatever industry you're in, always be learning.
Thank you. And a question from Henry, one of our other fellows. What technologies that are happening right now, for example, 5G, AI, self-driving car, do you think is going to change the world?
So self-driving cars are derivative of artificial intelligence, right? And so you have to understand AI. If you look at the top companies, like talk about my investment strategy now, I was talking to Kara about, right? The top companies, the FANGs, the very highest market cap companies in the world right now are the companies that do AI the best, period, end of story. And when you look at the Googles and the Facebooks and the Amazons in particular, and you wonder, how do they just keep on growing? There's not like something dramatic that's changed. It's because they know how to use AI behind the scenes to optimize everything. And it's taken them years to do that. Now, complement that with the fact that there's so much AI bullshit out there. Like every deal you see says, well, I've got this guy from this school who's an AI expert. And you have to be able to understand what's real and what's not real. And in running a business or investing in businesses or working for a company, you know, you've got to put in the time. I've sat down and I've done machine learning tutorials, taking Coursera AI classes, read books on it, because I need to know and I need to be able to understand if someone's crazy or real. So that's one. AI is driving everything. And then two, I wouldn't have said this to you a year ago, but now I think blockchain, like Justin and I were just talking about, I think not even so much Bitcoin. Bitcoin's become a store of value more than a blockchain for application, or using this blockchain for applications. And Ethereum and some of the other tokens, I think are, you know, the applications Justin and I just talked about, that's the exciting thing. I mean, it's just incredible what's going to be able to be done. Now, we're still early. It's like 1995, 1998, maybe, in the internet when it comes to blockchain. So there's still a long way to go, and there's going to be a lot of losers out of the ones that are out there, but there's going to be some winners, and there's still going to be some new companies that start that simplify and reduce the friction for typical end users. And when that happens, oh, it's going to be incredible. You know, if you do some work on DeFi, decentralized finance, and look to see how that works, because that's going to start to have an impact on personal banking. You know, if I put $2,000 in a bank account, in a savings account, and then I needed to pay a bill, and I went to that bank and said, I want to borrow $500 of it, they would make me jump through every hoop, wonder how much I'm making a week, you know, what's my credit score, all this stuff. If I put $2,000 into Ethereum and go on Aave and deposit it there, and then borrow $500, it takes 15 seconds.
Yeah.
I mean, the change is going to be so dramatic, and how we personally do things, you know, and handle our financing is going to be so dramatic that is an area for unlimited change right now. And it's going to be a great opportunity for someone.
Yeah, we're seeing algorithms basically replace all of the traditional gatekeepers and centralization.
In a lot of respects, yeah. And, you know, one of the things that people don't realize about DeFi and crypto is that they over-collateralize, right? Whereas, you know, we think a lot of cases that, well, I got to be borrowing more than I have, right? And then with crypto, it made people realize that there's a lot of people that may have $2,000 and just need to borrow $500 to pay one bill, knowing they're going to get paid in 2 weeks and they'll be able to pay it back, right? And there's just so much friction in the traditional financial system and banking system that this is going to change it. It's going to turn it upside down.
Awesome.
Yeah, Bill, one last question is from a fellow named Arian. What's your favorite founder that you're invested in and why?
There's so many. Mostly Shark Tanks are my favorite. You know, there's a woman by the name of Lani Lazzari who started a company called Simple Sugars, which is a scrub. Not that I'm a big scrub user, but she started when she was 11. She grew up in Pittsburgh, where I grew up, and she came on Shark Tank at 19, doing $40,000 a year in business. Now she's 26 and doing millions of dollars in business. There's another Shark Tank deal I did called Hug Sleep, which is just crazy. This couple couldn't sleep, right? Just could not sleep. And they thought about, you know, kids and what gets them to sleep. And with your son now, you're swaddling him all the time, right?
No.
And, you know, as your kids get older, you'll play burrito with them, where you wrap them in a blanket and unwrap them, right? So they came up with this thing that you put your feet into it and you just pull it up, kind of like a condom, if you will. But it's a stretchy material that's really light and really comfortable. I use it every single night, right? I pull it up. It helps me sleep. It's called hugsleep.com. They came on Shark Tank and sold $4 million worth within a couple weeks.
Wow.
It's crazy. It's crazy. So those are two of my favorites. I can list, you know, there's a company called Panoramic that came on Shark Tank, and they had an app that back then the iPhone had a flat base. And so you could just make it stand up, and using the app, it would just twirl around and you could do panoramic pictures. But then they changed the way the iPhone was shaped, and they pivoted to doing computer vision. So they went from being this close to being out of business 6-7 years ago to getting into computer vision, getting into doing it for cars, to selling their company to Carvana when the stock was like 22 and now the stock's like 250. So what was a good exit is now like an oh my God exit. And that was with them with their backs against the wall and pivoting, and Bruno, the CEO, having the foresight to do that and believing and buying in and putting in the work was just incredible.
I have a follow-up question, which is, you know, what's the common thread among entrepreneurs that you see just be successful?
They're nice, right? They're not dicks, right? They don't abuse people. They're not abusive of all. They're learners because, like I said, things always change. They love their products and their services so much, they love to sell it. They realize selling is helping. And they're agile because you know things are going to change and you have to be adaptive. You can't be stuck in your ways.
That's beautiful. Awesome.
That's great to hear. And thank you for the answer. And it looks like a lot of the investments that you make, you really bet on the jockeying, which is great to see.
Yeah, it goes both ways, right? But, you know, I want to see companies that come on Shark Tank Friday nights on ABC, by the way. And, I love it when they come in. And I go, why didn't I think of that? Like the Hug Sleep, right? And some others. So sometimes it's the product. And I try to think I can help the entrepreneur get where I need them to go, where they need to go. But you're right. You've got to, if you don't have one without the other, you'll fail.
Actually, I have another question. Do you have a favorite Shark Tank behind the scenes story?
Oh, there's so many of them. Yeah. There's so many of them. Most of the time. So Shark Tank, when you come on, they might last anywhere from 30 minutes for a stupid deal to 60 to 90 minutes. So in real time, they go on forever and a lot gets edited out. And there's just times, particularly Lori, where she'll say something and didn't realize that it's completely inappropriate. And so, you know, because she just doesn't think that way. And so it's a complete double entendre. And so one time, she'll kill me for saying this. So one time we had a vitamin company, and I hate vitamin companies on Shark Tank because they make all these claims, any supplements, right? And so they came on and it was spray, and the guy's sitting there and he goes, you know, a lot of people have problems swallowing vitamins, pills, right? So we created this spray. She goes, I have no problem swallowing. And we just died the minute, you know, because a guy throws on the set. And then, you know, her husband's back in the back laughing. And then she, it dawned on her what she had just said. So just those types of moments, or Barbara, or Kevin too. Kevin, you know, we like to pick on Kevin a lot because he's kind of a one-trick pony with royalties and licensing, you know, but there's times when he's got a really great heart and he tells great stories.
Awesome. Mark, thank you so much. This is
Justin.
Fun conversation.
It really was. I really enjoyed it. And thanks for the questions. And thank you, Tops, man. You're a superstar, bro.
All right, that was Mark Cuban, the legend himself. As always, bang out that 5-star ratings on iTunes. And next week, we're going to have my friend Laura Behrens Wu on the show. Laura is the founder and CEO of Shippo, a startup that has built a shipping API that serves over 50,000 customers like Goat, Hims, and OfferUp, and has raised over $60 million in capital. I will see you next week. Love you all, and I'm constantly inspired by this community. Thank you so much for listening. See you next time.